It's Learning to Listen with Quinn, Naomi, and Charlie.
Oh, yeah. Welcome, L2L Podcast, a.k.a. also known as, that's what a.k.a. stands for.
Okay.
Learning to Listen. Today, we are going to be talking all about number 77 on our Rolling Stones greatest hits of all time, greatest albums of all time. It's Who's Next by The Who. But before that, patreon.com/learningtolisten. Hey, as a thank you to you guys for hanging out with us, you know, we got some extra bonus content for you, but you got to go check it out. It's at patreon.com/learningtolisten. Only place you can get it. Episodes go up early. There's all kinds of bonus content, you know, that sort of thing. So patreon.com/learningtolisten. Okay, here's the opening spiel. This is L2L, where we're talking about music and the way we listen to music. We're trying to engage with the music we listen to. We're all about the lost art of engaged listening. So that's why we're talking about albums and consuming the album as a whole artistic statement, the way artists intended. This isn't a biography show, but instead it is a pure guttural and visceral reaction to the music we are listening to. My name is Quinn Clark. I am your host, of course. And with me, as always, I've got Fool Him Once, But You Can't Fool the Fool Again. Wait, how's that go? It's Charlie. Charlie, everybody.
Won't get fooled again.
Charlie Scream.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's right. And in the other corner, wearing the orange shirt, she still has Tiger Beat stashed under her bed, Naomi yep. Carmack.
You're right again, Quinn. You're right again. Hi. That's right. It's true.
Just all those pages of Leonardo DiCaprio just getting all dog-eared and crumbled up. All right. Anyway, no, we're doing Rolling Stones 100 greatest albums of all time, according to their top 500 list from 2012, amended in 2020. So today's album, like I said, is number, I think, 77 on our list, I believe.
Number 77.
So do you guys want to hear all about it?
Yeah. What is it?
It's called Who's Next. It's the fifth studio album by English rock band The Who. It developed from the aborted Lifehouse Project, a multimedia rock opera written by the group's guitarist Pete Townshend as a follow-up to the band's 1969 album Tommy. The project was canceled owing to its complexity and to conflicts with Kit Lambert, the band's manager, but the group salvaged some of the songs without the connecting story elements to release as their next album. 8 of the 9 songs on Who's Next were from Lifehouse, the lone exception being John Entwistle's penned My Wife.
My wife.
Man, that's so hard. Yeah, Charlie, I knew you would do it. what a hack. Like Chris Rock telling a bald joke. Ultimately, the remaining Lifehouse tracks would all be released on other albums throughout the next decade. Okay, so ladies and gentlemen, Rolling Stones, 100 greatest albums of all time. This is number 77. Guys, what do you know about Who's Next? Have you ever heard it before?
I've heard it plenty. I got it upstairs in my collection already.
Well, there we go. We answered that question.
Did you even have to do
show.
Research?
See you later.
Yeah, maybe
Good
not.
Good night, everyone.
What about you, Naomi?
I've heard of The Who. I've heard of Tommy and the Pinball Wizard and all that. And I've heard that the guitar player is a creepy pedophile.
I believe that's been debunked.
Oh, okay.
If we want to go there, but
exotics.
So I don't know about this exactly. I can't confirm anything, but I do know that he is a free man who has been able to go on tour around the world for like 30 years since he got accused of being a pedophile. But it has something to do like he was trying to help catch pedophiles. And and in doing so, people tried to turn it around on him and being like, well, I'll bet you if you searched his computers, you would find, questionable material.
Yeah.
And of course they did because he's like, yeah, it's me trying to catch pedophiles. So I don't know how that all panned out, but it seems like it came out in his favor. So I suppose he's been cleared. I suppose
so. Wow.
I mean, does that put your mind at ease? Are you listening to this album the whole time going like, I'm listening to a pedophile, just listening to a pedophile?
It really changes
the
name
of Michael Jackson.
Yeah. It really changes the name of the album. Who's next?
Oh, Charlie. It's true. But so, I listen to Michael Jackson.
Yeah. And now, technically, Michael Jackson settled out of court. So I don't know. And then there's those real weird. I could only watch the first half of that Finding or Leaving Neverland or whatever it was called.
This is a separating the art from the person.
Yeah, well, I'm going to say that I'm going to give Pete Townsend the benefit of the doubt because, you know, that was like a one-off thing and there hasn't been, there's not like a bunch of kids like making documentaries to this day about, you know, like, like all that sort of stuff. Like, I feel like, and especially in the Me Too and everybody getting canceled era by now, like more would have come out.
They would have come back to him, yeah.
So I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt. And, you know, let's clear his name off the top. I don't think he's a pedophile.
Okay.
So if that puts your mind at ease.
Does that change the way you've listened to the album?
Yeah.
Oh, I'll have to listen again, I guess.
But were you seriously just listening to this whole recording? Thing going, I'll like, come oh, I can't believe we're doing this album. This guy's a creepy pedophile.
No, no. I figured if he wasn't in jail by now, there must have been something that happened that was in his favor kind of thing, you know?
I mean, you know, it is what it is. Like if we have to separate the art from the artist, nonetheless, like, you know, okay. So Charlie, obviously not your first listen through.
No, sir.
Naomi, this was your first listen through.
Yeah. But I've heard like three of these songs before.
Oh, you can't stop hearing like at least three, if not more of these songs all the time. Always.
I was a little confused though, because is this a double album?
No.
Okay, well, whatever I got was like a double album on Amazon Music.
This album has been re-released so many times with so much bonus content.
Yeah.
That I believe the original version is actually only like a 40-ish minute album with like 9 songs on it.
Yeah, because I was looking for a version that was just like the straight ahead original album and I couldn't find one. It was all like this disc one, disc two thing. So I just kind of like, I listened to disc one and then I kind of be like, oh yeah, I heard that already.
Yeah, so yeah.
As long as you get up to Won't Get Fooled Again, you've done it.
Yeah, Won't Get Fooled Again is the outro song. You can kind of tell because it brings back the same synthesizer from Bob O'Reilly, which is the intro.
I was wondering, I was like, why do these songs sound exactly the same to me? Wait.
This bookend.
Well, we'll get into it in a second. We'll get into a second, but so definitely not my first listen through. I never had a copy of this, at least not a permanent copy. I probably ripped this one at some point from something or whatever. I do remember like listening to it as a young man with friends or something like that. The only album of the Who that I owned when I was young was Meaty, Beaty, Big and Bouncy, which was actually a greatest hits album that came out around the same era. But
it's
it was
about bouncy castles.
Absolutely.
Definitely not. Nope. It's about all their mod era hits, everything up through Tommy, right from My Generation to Tommy. So and it's got that era of music on it. That's the one I listen to the most. But it's not like I didn't hear these songs over and over and over and over and over again and still can't escape them to this day because, man, when it comes to classic rock radio, these songs get overplayed.
Yeah.
And, of course, then there's the whole fucking, like, CSI shows.
Yeah!
They can't stop using Who songs as their... It's like Iron Man movies with fucking AC/DC, right? Like, it's kind of a trope at this point that
yeah,
you
got
to pick a Who song to, and it's usually from this album for some reason. Anyway, I digress. So yeah, I was pretty familiar with it, but it's been a long time since I listened to it. So what was interesting to me about this listen through was the kind of the deep cuts, right? You know, the interior of the album, so to speak, you know, because the big songs are kind of at the beginning of the album and then towards the end of the album again.
The first three and the last two, right?
Yeah, basically. And then you get into the deeper cuts. But yeah, so the thing is too, like Naomi, you were saying that you kind of were like, oh, a lot of these songs sound the same. And the reason for that would be what we talked about off the top is how this was originally meant to be a follow-up to Tommy. Not like a sequel, but, you know, they had had a, what had made the Who complete, like they were a big enough band. They were selling records going back, to, especially in the UK, going back to like their first, you know, singles and stuff like My Generation and whatnot. You know, they're a big hit in the mod era of the like London music scene. In fact, they were kind of quintessential to that whole mod culture you know, everybody on fucking scooters and wearing shag haircuts and that sort of thing, right? But of course, those kids had grown up by this point and moved on, and the Who had also kind of moved on, and they'd gone into this new era where they had made this this rock opera, Tommy, that blew up and went international, and for the first time in their lives, they were millionaires and they were selling records internationally like they never had before. And so, of course, the move was make another rock opera, and sure, that was going to be called Lifehouse. And then they're like, well, how do we top Tommy? Well, then they were like, well, why don't we actually make this one a real musical, right? Whereas Tommy was conceived as a musical, but it was at this point hadn't been a musical. The musical version, the actual like staged and then filmed versions of Tommy came later. But in this case, they were like, well, why don't we actually make a real musical? And that's the multimedia part, right? Like they were going to do, you know, all kinds of film segments or stage production or whatever. But when that started to get like costly and they were fighting with their manager who just kind of wanted them to just make rock and roll records, that project fell apart. But in the process of writing this album and writing the songs for this album, you know, they realized that they kind of hit an evolution in their, you know, in their career, so to speak. And then of course, inspired by 2001, A Space Odyssey, which, you know, talks about the idea of like evolution and being pushed forward. You know, they were like, great, let's just call this Who's Next, as in like, this is the next thing the Who is going to do, the next step in our evolution. Mm-hmm. Got a picture of themselves in front of a monolith and yeah, put it out as a rock record with minus the so-called opera elements. But meanwhile, all of those elements that kind of tie the theme together, like you would in a musical, are still in this album. So that's why there's a lot of connective tissue between a song like right off the top, Bob O'Reilly, and at the very end, Won't Get Fooled Again, right? I don't know what the narrative was going to be. I didn't look into that at all. I just know that it was meant to be a space opera or something like that, which would have been cool because, you know, that would have been almost not like the better part of a decade before Star Wars. But of all story, of course, Star Wars wasn't a musical. I'm just saying, like, the idea.
A sci-fi rock opera, man. That would have been something else at that time.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess there was a taste for it, right? Like, I also probably inspired a bit by, like, 2001, which, you know, used a lot of classical music and whatnot. So there was a taste for it, for sure. But, yeah, there you go. Obviously, I would say the songs, though, seem to mostly be about relationships. So I don't imagine this was, like, about, like, going to war in space or anything like that. I feel like it's more of a classical opera, you know, about, like, you, I don't know, there's some romance involved or something. There must be. Anyway, yeah. So there you go. That's why they brought in, and that's part of the reason that they were inspired to bring in like elements of like that synth and whatnot. And they're kind of credited as being like one of the first bands in like the mainstream rock bands to start using elements of like synth rock and stuff like that. Although I don't know how much they deserve that, because I feel like there are a lot of people still already kind of using, especially keyboards and the Moog synthesizer and stuff like that, or had been around quite a bit at this point. But, you know, I guess maybe the fact that they were using it in such a directly, you know, rock, you know, like
way, very different kind of way.
Yeah. And I mean, the Who are also really credited with being kind of the band that invented stadium rock, you know, cause they had a reputation as being this big, loud band, and they always needed to push their sound bigger and bigger to hold on to the reputation. Plus they were popular enough that they filled big venues into, you know, like look what happened with like the Beatles, right? The Beatles are filling stadiums and nobody can hear them because the PAs and the sound equipment at the time just can't keep up. Well, I mean, the fact the fucking Marshall stack was invented for the Who, right? So that they could fill the sound of a large theater or even a stadium or whatever. Like some of the first like really big stadium PAs were cobbled together for the Who, you know, and like the light show and all that sort of thing that like hadn't been done quite to that point was, you know, the Who kind of ushered it all in because they were that band. They were big enough. So their sound had to get bigger and more epic. And, yeah, you know, like they had to keep up with like the theatrical side of things because that's kind of where they were, man. They were, you know, and they at this point kind of come by it, honestly, right? They had just drawn that much attention You know, I mean, they're theatrics when you think about like that whole thing of like smashing their equipment, Pete Townsend smashing his guitar. Like that might have started out of a night or two of like some frustration or just, you know, just going with the flow or whatever. But it wasn't long until guitar companies, manufacturers were the wanted to be the
smash our guitar.
Yeah, smash our guitar. Smash our guitar.
Smash ours.
And of course, he wasn't smashing like his prized guitars. You know, he would switch them out and come out with the at the encore with like, you know, whatever latest model that, you know, some guitar company had gifted him. And that's the one he would smash, you know. They would smash their cabinets, but like those cabinets would be like empty. They'd be shells. They're just there for show. And, you know, and they're running their the necks of their guitars and stuff through them. It's just cloth and plywood, right? It's the real amps are tucked off to the side, you know, that sort of thing.
That's showbiz, baby.
I know. So at that point, they're already like, you know, a pretty theatric band. So this is just them embracing it. Tommy was them really like, you know, going there, you know, conceptually. And I think this is them in a way, just kind of embracing it more and like, yeah, fuck it. It doesn't have to be an opera. It doesn't have to be a musical. It can just be rock. Mm-hmm. At least that's kind of my impression. And I believe this is internationally, at least this is probably their best selling record, like overall. So, you know, it worked, right? It didn't have to be a story. It didn't have to be a concept album, even though that's how it was envisioned. But yeah. So did you catch that at all? Like, or was that kind of lost on you? The fact that it was kind of, there was a connective tissue here. Like, did it seem like it was a concept record or did it just seem like they were just kind of, you know, using the same licks and tropes and instruments or whatever?
I think that if I had listened to the actual original version of the album, the concept part would have sunk in more clearly to me.
Right. Then it would cut off at the appropriate place.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, it like the middle of the album for most of those songs are, you know, I don't believe are connected to the overall narrative.
Mm-hmm. No.
I think the major narrative, although it says that, okay, so.
I mean, my wife definitely isn't part of the thing. It was more of like a comedy song.
Yeah. Okay. So I had a note about this because I was like, all right, without reading anything about it. And I had to guess which songs were connected to the musical side of things. I mean, I'm like, okay, well, Bob O'Reilly for sure. You know, that seems like it's pretty theatrical, right? At least the arrangement of it. Won't Get Fooled Again. I was like, well, that kind of bookends Bob O'Reilly. It's like the reprise at the end of a musical. That kind of makes sense to me. And then I was like, The Song Is Over is for sure written for a stage musical.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah, I get it. I believe
it. But according to, like, at least Wikipedia, the only song that wasn't from Lifehouse would have been My Wife. And it was just John Entwistle just getting his one song in there, you know? To be like, oh, can I get some royalties off this record? And they're like, all right, John, here you go.
I wrote a funny little tune. Check it out.
Yeah. And that's him singing it too, right? That's not Roger Daltrey.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I guess the rest of them are, but I don't know. Behind Blue Eyes? Does that seem like a song that was written for a musical?
Wait a minute. I always thought that was a Limp Bizkit song. Through and through. Come on.
Charlie, I know you're kidding, but man, having hosted karaoke
yeah,
and having people request that song and then you put on The Who's Behind Blue Eyes and they're like, this isn't the song.
That's not it.
And you're like, this is Behind Blue Eyes. They're like, no, I wanted the original. And you're like, think fucking Limp Bizkit wrote this song? Oh, no.
Yeah.
Okay, what's interesting to me, though, is because I know they started working on this with the Rolling Stones Mobile Studio. And there's a song called Going Mobile. And I always assumed that was just like them, not like a tip of the hat or a nod to the fact that they were like, hey, we started working on this album, you know, with the mobile studio. And it was just like, you know, written in a jam session or something. But I guess it's part of the overall narrative of Lifehouse.
It's a song about hippies that don't care about pollution. It says it right in it.
I guess, yeah. I just never paid attention to the lyrics before, yeah, so.
Just so, like, yeah. A lot like you were saying, you know, I've definitely heard this album a bunch of times, but this time paying attention to the middle meat of the album was the most interesting part for me. Getting in Tune and Going Mobile being the two bigger songs that I never really, you know, I'm sure I know I've heard before because I've heard the album about, like, many times, but I've never really paid the most attention to. And I think of the two, Getting in Tune is probably my favorite re-listening hit, or not hit, but like re-listening track from this album.
Yeah, I still think that the middle part of this album is definitely overshadowed by the bigger songs on either end.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's hard to, like, man, when you have an intro like Bob O'Reilly, like, that's pretty epic.
Yeah, hell yeah.
Right? Like, that's a solid intro, not just to a song, but like to the whole album. Like, it really pulls you in.
Hmm.
And I have to say, one of my biggest disappointments was seeing The Who live a few years ago. And it was a great show. Did really well. And what's cool was that, you know, you expect one thing from a band, but, like, you could tell that they changed their set list on the fly. You know, they were pretty good at, like, they were really, really, like, they were really personable.
Right. You
know? Kind of pretty charming. I mean, obviously, at this point, it's just the Roger Daltrey and Pete Townsend and whoever else, right? Like, you know, Keith Moon died a long time ago. Nobody on stage actually played the intro to Bob O'Reilly.
There were no synthesizers on stage.
There were keyboards, but it was at a part in the show where the stage goes black and the band steps off. You know, they're old guys, right? Like,
got to take an oxygen break for sure.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And, you know, you just hear the synth part, the, you know, start to play. And I'm expecting a spotlight to come on, like a keyboard player, like playing it. Nope. You just see stage in the dark. You can just see stage hands, like resetting the stage, tuning guitars, that sort of thing, putting them back in the. And then, you know, as it builds up, then you hear the piano part. Bung, bung, bung. Right. And I'm like, this is still a backing track.
Surely there was someone playing the piano at that point.
Nope. Nobody playing the piano at that point. The first thing you see is when a spotlight comes back on, it's Pete Townsend, like, playing the guitar chords.
Right.
And doing this classic Pete Townsend, like, you know, windmill. Right. And you're like, that's cool. But, like, I would have liked to have seen somebody play it.
Sure.
I mean, I get what they're doing. They're like, you know, they're taking a chance to have a 30-second, like, reset, right? Like a little break, mm-hmm. Get a glass of water, take their breath. That sort of thing, you know, long before they took an encore. Man, but, like, that was a real bummer. I mean, it sounded great. It sounded perfect. It sounded just like the album, right? But, like, I would have actually liked to have seen somebody play that, but no, it was a backing track. Mm. It was cool. I mean, then the band comes in and there's, like, the big drum fill into it and stuff like that too, right? You know, especially, like, Won't Get Fooled Again. I don't remember if the same thing happened on Won't Get Fooled Again, because I don't remember there being a big break before that. I feel like, you know, that had more of a, like, the band was still, like, all on stage and went into it. So maybe I just didn't catch if somebody was playing that live or not. But Bob O'Reilly, it was so obvious that it was, like, you know, it was a backing track. Somebody had hit play on something and then the whole band, you know, took their time getting back up stage, got to their spots and queued up right on time.
Sure.
Bang. But yeah, I mean, it was a good show. It was a really good show. It was, you know, they were so personable. They talked a lot. Like, there's a lot of good, clever banter between, you know, there's zero. The only other thing I would say, though, is poor Roger Daltrey, his voice, they were still playing all the songs in the original keys, but now he was kind of pulling his punches as it came to, like, his big vocal parts.
Mm-hmm.
So in the songs where there's, like, more than one, like, big note, he would save it for, like, the one. Like, he would save it, like, for, like, you know, he might, like, a backup singer or whatever might take over the other part, or at least just kind of fill in that space if there was, like, a big note on another song. And he would do it at least once per song that needed that performance, right? He would go big once, but that's it. Otherwise, he saved it. So, you know, it was cool because the other thing that kind of worked about that a little bit, though, is because, you know, the anticipation of the crowd going, like, oh, here's where he goes. Yeah.
Gonna do it.
Right.
Yeah.
Ow. And he didn't do it. And you're like, oh, you know, but you're like, okay. But then he does do it, you know, and then everybody's like, yeah, he did it.
He did the thing that I came to see him do.
So he got a big response out of the crowd, which I feel like, you know, is the way to do it. If you're going to be like, ah, I just don't have the vocal prowess that I once did. His voice, for the most part, for the rest of the show, sounded good. He didn't sound like he was struggling. You could just tell that, like, he picked and he really chose where he would, like, go big with his voice. Otherwise, he stayed in, you know, like, in key. Mm-hmm. His range sounded pretty good, mostly. Like, it didn't sound like he was struggling at any point. But that's probably because he, you know, he made those choices, like, not to really push it, you know. But then again, that's how you probably tour for, like, what's fucking 50 years?
Sure.
In fact, the album they were touring,
yeah,
the album they were touring was like called 50 or something. It was like, it was celebrating that they'd been touring for 50 years. And then on top of that, it was already 2 or 3 years into that tour.
Right.
So yeah, they've been out there for a while. So I don't know. What did you guys like? It's kind of hard to talk about this album because honestly, I just think it's a good record. It's a solid record. Production's great. Songs are great. You know, like, it starts, opens big. It's like, it finishes strong. It's so familiar. We've heard so much of this so many times. So yeah, like, for me, it was more interesting in the middle only because it was stuff I was less familiar with. And it was stuff that was a little more, you know, of this kind of, I don't know, I don't want to say standard, but do you know what I mean?
Like, just slightly deeper cuts.
Yeah. Yeah. Just stuff I haven't
even
heard
that. I've heard the song is over before, like, even on the radio and shit like that too. But like, the My Wife, Getting in Tune, and Going Mobile, those are deeper cuts, I think, even on a huge record that is, you know, a giant legendary record like this one.
Yeah. I like that Going Mobile song. I like that one.
Because it
also, even that title seems to have more of a different meaning back then than it does now. because at first I'm like, huh? But then I'm like, oh, the original meaning of the song. Okay. It's, of the word mobile. Okay.
Funny that it hasn't been co-opted for a cell phone company yet.
I wonder.
I bet they've tried.
Well, I mean, obviously these guys are willing to license their music.
Yeah.
Right.
They like money. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe it has been used like regionally for like a mobile, you know, cellular phone company or something.
Sure.
We just don't know. I'll bet you if you looked it up, I'll bet you find somebody somewhere. I don't know. Yeah. Any thoughts though? But like production, I mean, obviously I haven't, Charlie, did you listen to this on your vinyl copy?
Yeah, I did both. Actually, I listened to it digitally and I also listened to it on my vinyl copy. My vinyl copy is a little bit, you know, more worn down. It's not as pristine as some of the other records I've got, but it still sounded awesome.
Okay, but
it was good to listen to it on both because, just like Naomi, when you go to listen to like the digital version, there's not a standard version. There's all these deluxe. It's all deluxe, right?
Yeah, I could not find an unremastered version. So
yeah.
I thought it sounded great, especially in the car stereo. I was listening to it in the car and I was like, oh man, whoever mixed this was like thinking about people like driving and listening to this, because this is where, out of all the places I listened to it, this is where it sounded the best to me. It was, or mixed the best, like, especially the stereo separation. I really noticed the stereo separation in the car more than I even noticed on like headphones or whatever.
Sure.
Especially like in that intro with Bob O'Reilly, where it kind of starts going between, like, panning between speakers.
Right.
I was like, why am I really noticing this in the car more than anywhere else? But, but like, you know, kind of getting past the fact that, yeah, you probably have an older, worn.
Well, I'll tell you, I love synthesizers. So I love the synthesizers on this album. They sound amazing.
Yeah, it works really well here.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even think of it as a synthesizer. Like, I think of it more of like, you know, because it's really just like a, like, what's the word I'm looking for? Vibrato expression. Right. Like, I know some old amps that would have that built in. And I remember a buddy of ours that, you know, we once played music with once upon a time. He found this old amp, like some like Sears kind of, I don't know, you know, like off brand, you know, not Fender, not Marshall, not Vox or anything like that. And it had a setting on it that he could turn up. you know, this like vibrato or something. And then it also, I think it was meant to kind of imitate those like those Leslie style rotating speakers.
Sure, sure.
To give you that Doppler effect. Mm-hmm. And when he cranked that up, it gave you the Bob O'Reilly sound. Of course, he's running a guitar through it, not an organ. But I was like, oh, if you were running an organ through it, it would imitate that sound pretty well. So, I mean, obviously they're using a synthesizer here to make the same effect, but
right.
But you know, I'm like, I guess I just, when I think synth, I think more of the Moog sound.
Totally. Yeah.
And less of these, like, you know, expression effects.
Right.
So maybe that's one of the reasons this works, is because it's less jarring. It feels fitting, you know.
If it would have been like a Moog type sound, you would have noticed it more. It would have been like, you know, more plunky or something, more
little square notes. Yeah, yeah.
But another thing is, I mean, obviously the intro and the outro tracks have, you can, that's, those are the big, you know, synthy show pieces. But the synth is going through like most of the album, but it's just like so nicely tucked in there that like you don't even really think about it half the time. You're just like, yeah, this is just the Who, and you're like, oh no, wait, yeah, no, okay. There's synth in there. I get it. I hear it now.
Yeah, to my ears, it's like, you know, from our generation's point of view, by the time we heard all this, like the Who had their career, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and these songs at that point were bigger than their previous songs. And I would have probably heard some of these first before right. I got my hands on Meaty Beaty, Big and Bouncy. So I actually remember being surprised the other way, because to me, you know, when I picked up that copy of Meaty, it was more interesting to me to hear their more old, they're like Magic Bus, they're like I Can See for Miles, you know, My Generation, mm-hmm. that sort of stuff, where I'm like, oh, this isn't like as big and epic in production scale. This is a smaller thing. This is a little, you know, I don't know if I, at the time, I would have thought of it as being a little more punk rock, but like, I do remember some of my punk rock friends kind of being into like the early Who,
sure,
you know, because like, you know, maybe their influence on the mod scene or like the London scene at all. I know that like the being like the first band that being, you know, considered to be the big loud band or whatever, the joke used to be like the whole reason the Beatles made Helter Skelter,
right,
was in a response to the Who, to be like, well, we can be more loud and abrasive, right?
We'll do big. We'll be loud.
Yeah. So I can see why, you know, they kind of get left out of the conversation of like the pedigree of like proto punk or whatever, you know, that usually gets given to like, obviously, you know, like Iggy and the Stooges and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But I feel like the Who have a hand in that legacy as well, or in that history. But by this point, though, they would have moved away like from that, and they're going into this like, this is a much tighter production, this is a bigger, more epic, like this is that stadium rock sound, right. And I wonder just, you know, how jarring that was to their early fan base, you know, like that movement away from the mod, early mod sound.
And the Who sold out. I don't like them anymore.
Well, they have an album.
I know.
Two albums before this one, you know. I think it's the album before Tommy that's called The Who Sell Out, right?
The Who Sell Out, of course.
Yeah. It's the one that's got all the big joke. But, like, I don't remember if the songs on that one are specifically... I feel like Tommy's the one where it's like... That might have been a joke about, you know, not every song sounds like My Generation anymore when they made that album cover. But, like, Tommy is a completely different thing, right? Like that's a passion project, you know, that took them in a completely different direction, and it worked. It caught the attention of an international market that they hadn't had before. So I'm just wondering, is it like, you know, is it like Metallica with like the Black Album or Load, where, you know, they're showing up on the charts a little bit here and there, you know, throughout like the 80s, and they're building their like diehard fan base, and then all of a sudden they're like, oh, and by the way, our songs are now 3 minutes and, you know, like verse choruses and polished or whatever, like, you know, prefer FM radio. But in this case, it's like the opposite, where it's like they go from our songs,
here's more of a rock opera for you.
Yeah. And now our songs are 8 minutes and, yeah, you know, like have movements in, instead of like tight, like verse chorus arrangements.
Stretch our legs a little more.
Yeah. Do you think that there's a bunch of mods back then going like, oh, fuck the Who? Like, yeah, they used to be cool.
Sure. Like, sure. As long as any artist is going to evolve, there's going to be fans that are going to want the original, you know, like an artist doesn't necessarily want to do the same thing for 100 years. So they're like, all right, okay, well, what else can we do? Right. So, and, but then you're always going to have the people who are like, nah, I like the first thing you did. You nailed it. Then you never should change anything else.
You're damned if you do. And you're damned if you don't. Totally. Honestly.
Cause yeah, you're going to get the
you're
other
called a sellout. If you change.
Yeah.
Fucking stupid.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I do know that Pete Townsend was kind of out of all the members of the Who was the most uncomfortable with their success, though, even though it was kind of his fault because he was the one pushing the band in this direction. Mm-hmm. Right.
Right.
But he had found some sort of spirituality or something like that. He was studying. I don't know if he'd gotten into like Eastern, meditation or something at the time. But out of everybody, I remember that he was like embarrassed to be a millionaire, you know, like he was like, that's not in keeping with like the lifestyle or the image, right, I want to portray or whatever.
Sure.
Obviously Keith Moon just went off the deep end and right, like partied and like, you know, like ended up, I always thought that they found Keith Moon floating in a pool, but I didn't really do a deep dive, but I wasn't able to corroborate that on like my quick preliminary search of information about the Who. All I found was that apparently the last time anybody saw me was partying with Paul McCartney at a birthday party that Paul McCartney, like, well, not just Paul McCartney, at a party that Paul McCartney was throwing to celebrate like the Buddy Holly's birthday. Like, it's just an excuse, like, you know, to have an event and host a bunch of people.
Sure.
And that at the point that time he had obviously been really struggling with alcoholism, and his doctors had prescribed him some kind of drug that was supposed to help with like coming down off of alcohol, you know, help with like, I guess, detoxing or something like that. And he overdosed on that prescribed drug. But the story I'd always heard, like as I was, you know, a kid, if there was a joke or something for years and years about like Keith Moon, would always be like that they found him floating in a pool.
Totally. Yeah.
And yeah, I don't know if that's true or not. I guess I could look that up, but
nah.
But
just keep perpetuating the myth.
But yeah, the band went strong for this album came out in what year?
71.
And the band went strong till about 78, I believe, ish, around the time when Keith Moon died. And then I guess technically any time that they've toured or performed or released anything, it's been kind of under the status of a reunion.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think they've truly been inactive for any long period of time. They still put out like new material. I guess probably as recently as that last album that I think it was a combination of I didn't pick it up. I didn't listen to it. It had a terrible album cover. But that was enough for me to be like, oh, this looks kind of last minute slapped together, like they need to tour something.
Well, it looks
apparently
like
it had original material on it.
It looks like they took a couple of years off here and there. So they go from like 64 to 83, and then they skip to 85, and they skip to 88 to 91. And then they take like 5 years off, 96 to 97, and then they take 98 off, and then 99 to present. So,
yeah. Musically, this album is, I mean, pretty solid. I don't think you hear anything that's like mind blowing as far as performance goes, right? There's some good drum fills from Keith Moon. And, mm-hmm. You know, there's what you expect from Pete Townsend on guitar. And, Naomi, you know, I kind of always look to you for like your thoughts on vocal performance. How do you feel about Roger Daltrey's voice on this album?
I don't know. I kind of consider him a pretty basic singer. Like, there's nothing mind blowing happening there, in my opinion, from what I was listening to.
Yeah. I think everybody's always thought of him as a competent singer. I don't think he's ever been considered like an earth shatteringly, but the one thing that
he portrays the story of the song quite well.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's cool. But I mean, yeah, nothing earth shattering. I agree.
Obviously he's got his moments though, like his big yowls and stuff like that. Right? And unfortunately, like I said, he's not hitting every single one in concert anymore, but got to give the guy a break. He's like, what, in his 60s, pushing 70?
For sure.
Like, but the fact that he's still out there touring and probably doing, you know, at the time that I saw him, they were easily doing as many as 200 shows a year still. Like, that's, you know, that's a... Like my grandpa wasn't fucking getting up on stage 200 times a year, like in his 60s, right? So I'll give it to him. You know, he's got longevity, and I think, yeah, vocally got the job done, right? He had a voice that was powerful enough early on in the career to like cut through the noise of a loud backing band, like to get over, like just imagine that those rehearsals with like shitty old PA gear, like if they even had a PA to like rehearse with, like he was probably just screaming over top of, you know, you're in a room with John Entwistle, Pete Townsend, and Keith Moon, and all you've got is your voice. Like, I think there's a reason that, like, you know, he's a yelly guy. Like, I think he comes by it honestly. I think he had to, right? Like, I mean, man, that's why early on in the career, like a song like My Generation, where he's just really playing with the vocal there, or he's doing that kind of half intentional stutter, you know, which is, I think, half a joke to be like, is he going to say the F-bomb? But then, you know, it's like, because what you got to bring something to the table, right? Like,
sure.
And if you're not fucking, I don't know, I'm trying to think of a contemporary vocalist at the time that would have been, you know, but like whoever, but yeah, then you got to bring some expression, and I think he does it. I think he pulls it off, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. Like I said, the only problem I really have with this album at this point is that a lot of these songs are overplayed, you know. Like, I've heard them so many times that I'm kind of a little numb to them. It's hard to be impressed. I was glad to have this listen and be like, okay, this is an intentional listen.
Mm-hmm.
Because it made me go, oh, yeah, I have to, like, judge this song on its merits again, or this album on its merits again, and not just like, oh, I'm watching, you know, CSI Miami.
Like, so that's basically every night for you.
Well, no, it's not. But I'm just saying, you know, like, that's it's just one of those things. It's just so...
Yeah.
If I turn on... Okay. What are the chances that I turn on one of our local classic rock stations right now? Like, we've got K97, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably a one in like 100 chance, which is not like that bad of odds, that a Who song will be playing right now, and it'll be one of these songs, right?
Totally. Yeah.
Like, okay. I couldn't count how many times I've gotten, you know, in the car, or we've got a radio like in the shower, and one of the stations it picks up is K97, and I just have it on there because, like, why not, right? Like, it's as neutral a station can get, that, you know, I might hear a traffic report, right? And Bob O'Reilly is playing.
Sure.
I mean, but I guess that speaks to their legacy.
Well,
they're
that's
a
just
fucking
it.
Popular band. I mean, and this album is their most popular album as far as I know.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess there's a reason, right? These songs are pretty good. So I don't know. I don't know what else there is to really say about it. You know, I feel like people are pretty familiar with this record for the most part.
That's just it. And I think that's something getting deeper into, or closer to the, you know, to the top album, it's going to become more and more. There's been some surprising things so far where it's been like, you know, I've never heard of this album before. But once you get into like the top 50 or 25 or even top 10, you're going to be like, yeah, of course.
Well, maybe, song, you know, maybe, but then again, this is supposed to be a critical list, not a popular list, right? And of course, you know, there's going to be some crossover there, but, you know, I think there'll still be room to be surprised. You know, I guess, like, we know there's, it's like, okay, everybody knows The Godfather, knows about The Godfather, but has everybody seen The Godfather? A lot of people have.
Yeah.
But your average everyday moviegoer, you know, especially younger people who, you know, they've heard the name, they know references to it or whatever, but have they ever sat down and watched it?
Sure.
Maybe not, right? Because, you know, it's not Spider-Man 3, right? Like, It's an old movie that maybe their parents watched. It was critically acclaimed, but did it make the most money in the world? Is it the most popular movie of all time? Hell no.
No, that's Scarface.
Yeah, well, yeah. Well, if you're going to compare gangster movies. Yeah, definitely there are more Scarface posters on more college dorm room walls than there are Godfathers. But sure, there's probably still a few Godfathers. But, you know, there's definitely a few Who posters on some college dorm rooms too, right?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
So you know, I don't know. In this case, sometimes I'm like, well, I think, you know, it would be interesting to try and dig deeper about this, but I just don't know what we could unearth that, you know, like what else is there to know about this thing?
I mean, aside from like, and I'm pretty sure they exist, but like finding the Lifehouse rock opera versions of the, you know, like reordered, take all the songs that were supposed to be in the musical and then like reorder them and listen to that. That would be the difference.
Or just find a treatment for it and find out like what the story was meant to be. Well, I couldn't really piece together much of a story. Like I was saying earlier from these songs, I was like, they seem to be mostly about relationships.
Well, here's the thing is I did a quick look for it and there's apparently like two or three different, or maybe even four different versions. Like there's a 1971 version, a 1972 editions, 1978 version, and then a 1999 radio play version. So there's plenty still in there of what they wanted, or maybe I'm not sure.
Did it get produced that 1999 version? Because like, that'd be something to find and listen to.
Yeah. I think the 1999 radio play version of the script is available on Lifehouse Chronicles. Townsend and along with playwright Jeff Young completed a musical radio play script of Lifehouse as a collaboration between BBC Radio Drama and Eel Pie, Townsend's publishing company. So they actually went ahead later on. So
it was released eventually.
Yeah.
Well, interesting. I mean, yeah, I was not aware of that at all. Okay. I mean, so, you know, sometimes I'm like, hey, what do you guys think this one's about? And I'm like, well, I don't know. What was it about?
It was about love in space.
Yeah, exactly. Did you get a story from this at all? Did you listen to this and go like, oh, there's a clear kind of narrative here?
Well, I'll tell you what I wouldn't have gotten is the sci-fi. Aside from the fact that they were using synthesizer, I didn't get like a definitive like, yeah, this sounds like space. You know, this is spacey.
Well, okay. Like, let me put it this way. When you listen to Tommy, it's clearly a story, right? There's a beginning, a middle, and an end. The songs, you know, like you can tell what narratively they're more or less about, right? Mm-hmm. You know, like a song like Pinball Wizard is pretty on the nose that it's like, it's about a deaf, dumb, and blind kid who sure plays a mean pinball, right? Like it is. His name happens to be Tommy. In this one, I'm like, I don't know. There's no character that's defined.
Yeah.
There's no like, there doesn't seem to be like a singular premise that's like, it's about this.
I mean, that might have been something that kind of they may have trimmed out of the original songs or something like that, right?
Maybe, or
like once they're like, well, maybe this isn't really going to work as an opera. Maybe we need to, you know,
plan was that this one would have had more of like if it was a proper stage production, that more of that would have been left up to like dialogue in the interim between songs as opposed to the songs themselves.
Fair enough.
Which, if that's the case, maybe that's why this album still works, is because they were written purely as songs and not as part of a narrative.
Right.
You know, it's tough. Okay. What kind of musicals, or do you guys like musicals? Let me just ask that question first.
No,
not generally. They not have to all. Have something special to them.
Like if I go like, what's your favorite musical? You don't have one.
Hamlet 2.
Yeah, well, not a musical, really, but okay.
I think it's because when I want to watch a movie, I just want to watch some acting. I don't want you to sing me the fucking movie.
Stop singing at me all the time.
Because there are musicals where they sing everything like a Les Miserables, right? Where, you know, God, if somebody asks for somebody to pass the sugar, you know, for their tea, they'll like, pass the sugar. I need my tea sweetened. And you're like, okay, like, I'm pretty sure you could have said that. You know, then there's the other ones where the songs kind of are there as punctuation to illustrate, you know, something about it, but it's not necessarily what moves the narrative forward, right?
More like a cabaret.
Yeah, like cabaret.
That's the kind of musical I can get behind.
Yeah.
Rock of Ages is the closest thing to anything, a musical that I would have enjoyed.
Okay. So, like, have you ever seen Tommy?
No.
No, actually, I have not actually seen it.
You've never seen Tommy, hey? No. Really? Elton John? As Tommy's rival? Okay. Well, interesting.
No, I just have no interest in watching a musical. I'd rather turn on pretty much anything else.
Well, I'm kind of surprised. I mean, there's part of me that understands because, like, when I was younger, like, I was like, ugh, musicals. I remember the first time I saw a lot of, like, Disney movies when I was a kid. As soon as I started singing, I was like, what? Singing in a Disney movie?
Lions can't sing.
Lame. I hated it.
You can't sing under the ocean, man.
I kind of grew out of it, and I came around and started to kind of enjoy musicals for what they are, right? I mean, yeah, I don't love all musicals. So, yeah, I came around to musicals eventually.
Yeah.
Not all of them. They're not all good. They're like any other medium, right? Some of them are good. Some of them are bad. I don't just like musicals just because it's a musical.
Right.
You know, I go with some discretion. But I've gone to my share and watched my share and whatnot. And, I feel like it is a difficult medium in this day and age. I feel like musicals were a thing that it was a real piece of escapism, you know, that people indulged in more or were more willing to indulge in a different era, mm-hmm. where your options for entertainment were a little more limited. And, you know, it's kind of a whole package, right? You get the song, you get the dance, you get the story,
sure.
You get it all in one evening. It feels, you know, it feels bigger. It feels more epic. It just, it, I can understand why the musical has kind of fallen a little bit by the wayside. And anybody who's still doing it is more or less doing it out of kind of, you know, a passion for the idea more than they're like trying to make a buck because you're taking a chance, right? With a musical. So yeah, it's interesting to me that a band that was a contemporary rock band in their era, probably in a time where musicals were, you know, I guess they were still in fashion at some point, you know, more probably for family entertainment than anything. But that's the direction they would go. I mean, in years after this, obviously because of the success of even things like this, that probably proved that there was a taste for things like Grease, you know,
right.
Like, well, I'm not a fan of Grease. You know, I don't like Grease that much. I think the songs are okay. I think they may be a little oversaturated too. Like, I've heard those songs way too many times in my life, and they don't do it for me. And I just don't think the story of Grease is all that great.
Sure,
you know, at least the movie version. Anyway, I feel like the stage version is a little bit different. The stage version is a little more punk rock than the movie version. The movie version is just a little too watered down and weird for me. It's a very 70s movie about the 50s, which is just kind of, I don't know. But people love it. People
do love it.
People fucking love it. So I don't remember why I was asking you guys originally about musicals, but I guess I was just curious to see where you're at with the musical. Like, you know, so if you're not on board with musicals in general, would, like, you know, there was nothing about this album though that turned you off because of its musical elements.
Oh, no. I can like the music from a musical. I just don't want to watch the musical.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. Now, I would say the most painful version of a musical is dinner theater. But, you know, that's just because of, you know, it's more regional actors, lower production. It's really awkward when cast members also have to be your waiter and come to your table in character between acts and serve you your fucking, you know, prime rib or whatever. But hey, I, you know, it's a quaint evening though. And if you can kind of get past some of that stuff, it can be fun. But you know, I'll bet you if I took you guys to see something like Book of Mormon.
Oh yeah. I bet I'm sure I'd like that.
Yeah. it's a comedy. It's kind of crass. You know, the songs are funny.
I'm not totally anti-musical, but there has to be an angle that I would like.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what? When you think about it, anything done by the guys from South Park, I like.
For sure.
Yeah.
Cannibal
so I
musical.
Guess I can't say I completely hate musicals because I like what they do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I get it, though. I get it. Like, it's sometimes it's hard to sit through certain musicals. I remember, like I was saying earlier, and I'll say it again. I remember the first time I saw Nightmare Before Christmas as a kid. I saw it in the theater. I hated it.
That's one that just makes sense to me. But I guess, I don't know. I feel like animated things like that, as they are musicals, but it just seems different because they're just animated.
So you can kind of accept everybody breaking out into song.
Like, yeah, there's going to be singing in this for sure.
But I came around, right? Like, you know, as I got older, I rewatched that movie, you know, several times since. And, you know, now I'm kind of sucked up by the whimsy of it all, right? You know, like, and the songs are catchy and good, right? So to me, that's all it really needs is if it's a good story and the songs are catchy and good, then, hey, I'll give your musical a chance. All right. I don't know. Is there anything else to be said about this? Not really, hey?
Nah.
Well, I wish we could give a deeper dive. I don't know. But this is a pretty popular album. Everybody knows it. I don't think we're going to bring any fucking new hot takes to this other than anything we've said already. So do you guys want to hear what Rolling Stone had to say about it?
Do tell.
Yes.
Okay. The Rolling Stone magazine put this at number 77 on their greatest albums of all time out of 500. And they said, Pete Townsend suffered a nervous breakdown when his planned follow-up to the rock opera Tommy, the ambitious theatrical Lifehouse, fell apart. But he was left with an extraordinary cachet, or cash, I don't know how you guys say that, of songs that The Who honed for what became their best studio album, Who's Next? Won't Get Fooled Again, Bargain, and Bob O'Reilly, named in tribute to avant-garde composer Terry Riley. All beam with epic majesty, often spiked with synthesizers. I like synthesizers, Townshead said, because they bring into my hands things that aren't in my hands. The sound of the orchestra, French horns, strings. You press a switch and it plays it back at double speed. Hmm. Yeah, so there you go.
There it is.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think that brought any anything really, you know. No epiphanies there. Charlie, where was it in the previous?
Well, boy, how the mighty have fallen. It last time back in 2012? It was number 28.
Okay.
So tumbled down like 50 or so.
Wow, way up there. Here's the thing too, is Tommy on this list is back at 150. So,
oh, that's weird. I thought it would be the other way around. Like,
you think that Tommy would be a higher?
Well, I feel like it would be more groundbreaking than this. You know?
Yeah, you're right. You know, for the fact that it would be kind of more groundbreaking, that you think it would rank higher. But I think this is just overall more enjoyable record, right?
Well, this is interesting. You know? Previously in slot 77 is something we've already gone through, Back in Black, AC/DC.
You know, okay, there's one thing that I can comment on that I hadn't thought about. Or I had thought about earlier, but I had forgotten about it until you just mentioned AC/DC. I hear a lot of influence on AC/DC from The Who. You know, okay. Especially those intros, like sure. The kind of stuff that Angus Young is doing on guitar really kind of matches the sort of stuff you hear on like the synthesizer in this album. Those like big, you know, stabs on the one from like the band, those big band hits, right? Like that AC/DC. Think about like a Thunderstruck.
Right.
Right. Like, tell me The Who does not have a ton of influence on a song like Thunderstruck.
Yeah, I get it for sure.
You know? Yeah. Yeah. I was listening to this. I should have made that note and I didn't, but I'm glad that you mentioned AC/DC because it just made me remember that. I was going like, man, now that I'm listening to this and we had just listened to Back in Black not that long ago, I was like, I've never really noticed how close some of what AC/DC was doing sounds like what The Who was doing.
Oh, they
not that long before
picked up the ball with what worked and ran with it.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, if you were to make a classic rock mixtape, it kind of makes sense to have AC/DC and The Who both on there, right?
Sure.
So anyway, okay, well, here's the real question. Well, do you guys first, do you think it deserves its ranking?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, me too. I don't really have any problem with it. I wasn't looking at it going like, why is it? This shouldn't be here. It felt right. Mm-hmm. But the real question is it going in your record collection? I mean, Charlie, we already know you have it.
Yeah. Yes.
No. I guess like these, like you said before, some of these songs you've heard so many times, I have no real interest in hearing them again. But it was kind of cool to hear some of the other album tracks that I wasn't familiar with, but they didn't do much for me. It was just kind of meh.
Mm.
So that's why I'd go with a no on that.
Okay. Well, I think that in the greater canon of music, I think I would put this in my record collection. It's not anything that I'm like running out to get right now, but it's something that it's like, you know, a good clean copy of this somewhere, you know, along the line and be like, oh yeah, you know what? Just because it's like, yeah, this is a solid record. I could throw this on and keep a crowd happy. To me, this is like in the same camp as like Fleetwood Mac's Rumors.
Okay. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like it just lives in that kind of wheelhouse of like a record you could put on at a party and everybody would be happy.
It's an easy pleaser.
Yeah.
True.
Okay. But Naomi, since you said no, and I've, you know, been feeling like you need help with your record collection. We got to like...
But, I like my collection.
You get a tiny.
We just never talk about the albums that I actually like. So
okay, well, so I figured, you know, well, because we're doing this list, and you know, we could maybe do some like you know, Naomi's picks or something like that. But I thought I only do
bargain bin. That's all I like.
Only in the bargain bin. Thank you.
But you picked some good bargain bins. Like you suggested some good ones. But I was thinking about, like, you know, you're always saying how you don't like any of this stuff. You don't like any modern music. You know, you got your like little window and mm-hmm. that you're sticking to it or whatever. But I was like, you know what? It would be a fun little challenge to see if we could maybe crack that nut, you know, that hard nut to crack, which is Naomi's record collection. And so Charlie and I have decided that we're going to challenge each other to find modern songs, new songs. So not, you know, not old songs, not anything to be like, oh, I'll bet you like this song from the 90s, right? Like that's,
you that's know, too that's, easy.
That's too easy. Like you're going to be like, yeah, of course, yes. You know, oh, I have Bobby Brown's whole fucking discography. But but songs from new artists that maybe might tickle something in your taste center in your brain that might make you go like, oh, actually, I could get behind this. You know, maybe stuff that's not obvious. Maybe it's not on the radio. Maybe people aren't asking for it at karaoke, so you're not like hearing it there or anything like that. And so the whole deal, though, is a contest between me and Charlie, and we're gonna pick a song each week, and we're gonna ask you to listen to our songs, just the song. You don't listen to the whole record or anything like that. And then you can tell us if you liked one of our songs, none of our songs, whatever. And we're gonna just keep a tally going and see who just as a way to make it competitive, just a little, you know, a little competitive, no prizes or anything like that, but who
just bragging rights,
who can crack Naomi's nut.
Fair
we
enough.
Might need a better name than that. I don't know. So here's the thing, though, is if you want to find out who Naomi picked, if she picked anything, you got to go on Patreon, patreon.com/learningtolisten. So do you want to hear which songs we picked for you?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. So I'm only going to play just a little tiny clip, you know, whatever of the song. Okay. Charlie, I don't know if you have yours ready or not.
Oh, I didn't have mine ready to play.
I'll give you a second. But I've decided there's an artist called Dijon or Dion. Dion, maybe.
Is it spelled?
I'm not sure. It's spelled Dijon.
Mm-hmm.
And the song is Talk Down.
Okay.
Are you familiar with it at all?
No.
No? Okay.
I've heard of Dijon.
I'll give you just a little clip here and just a little taste for the audience. And then maybe, Charlie, you can tell us your song and give us a little taste.
It's not really coming through.
No.
Oh, not coming through. Okay.
It's playing in your room, but I can't.
Let me fix that right now. Sorry, guys. I thought I had that prepared.
It's okay.
Oh, here we go. That's why. Okay. Try that again.
That is a New Jack Swing beat.
All right, that's my pick. It's called Talk Down.
Okay.
Okay. Charlie, what do you got?
Well, I see that this is going to be a tough first round already, and given that you were like, yep, that's New Jack, that's the New Jack Swing Big Die, I know what that is. I'm picking something from a band I've been listening to lately, or it's not really a band, it's more of a side project, or a project from Shooter Jennings and Yellow Wolf called Sometimes Why, and this is a song called Hole in My Head. Now, I don't really have a part set aside or anything. Let's just try to jump into the song and see where we get to. And I'll just fade it out.
Ah, cool. All right.
All right. So if you want to know if Naomi picked one of those songs or none of those songs, you want to see what kind of points we racked up here, you got to go patreon.com/learningtolisten. We'll have that on the next episode for you, which is going to come out earlier than the regular feed. And of course, there's other kinds of bonus content on there. I mean, if you want to check out today's episode, we give our hot takes about the whole Oscar situation. So patreon.com/learningtolisten. All right. And also, if you want to know what we're doing and follow along anywhere else, we are all over the interwebs with our social media. Of course, it's all accumulated into one place called a website. Charlie, what is that website?
It's l2lpodcast.com.
Right on. And if you have any hot takes for us about anything we're doing, the artists we're listening to, the albums we're doing, whatever, your thoughts, your feelings, you just got to get something off your chest. Why don't you call us? Maybe we'll play you on the show if you've got something interesting to say. What's that phone number, Naomi?
It's 780-851-8785.
Hell yeah. Okay. And of course, our hosts also have things going on in their lives that they'd like to share with you. Those things are called plugs. What are your plugs, guys?
Hey, man, come on down to oldmandesign.com. You want merch? I want to sell you merch. You like this podcast? I want to sell you merch from this podcast. Oldmandesign.com. We got all kinds of shirts. I'm just putting new shirt designs up daily. I'm just going crazy with shirt designs. Go to oldmandesign.com. We'll get you sorted.
Right on. Naomi, what do you got going on?
The podcast called Dope Nostalgia, where we talk to and about artists from the 90s. This week's guest is 90s freestyle artist Karina.
Right on, right on, right on. Okay, well, thank you everybody for hanging out and listening today. You know, wherever you find us, make sure that you like and subscribe to follow along. If you want to know what we're doing next week, we are going to be doing number 76 on our Rolling Stones Greatest Albums of All Time list, Curtis Mayfield's Superfly. So yeah, right on. I can't wait for that one. And until then, I guess all we have left to say is, oh God, I had one and now I'm losing my nerve here. I was going to say, but just like when they found Keith Moon floating in a pool, the medics were like, wrap it up. See, that's where you use that, Carol.
The 1990s. The music was fun,
yeah.
And then it got really dark for a while, a little bit anti-establishment.
But the next thing you knew, it was totally fun again.
So many artists came and went and left us wondering, what are they doing now? This podcast isn't about the heavy hitters who are still making millions. It's about everyone else, the ones whose careers didn't really leave that decade and kind of just still live in our memory.
So you mean Vanilla Ice had another song?
We all know what happened to Marky Mark. But what about the Funky Bunch? Who were the KLF? And why did Tammy Wynette record a song with an electro dance band that topped the charts? Two genres that specifically defined the 90s. What were freestyle and New Jack Swing all about?
you know that Blossom star Joey Lawrence had a huge pop hit? Or that Alanis Morissette had a really hot pop career in Canada before Jagged Little Pill? Special guests will also be joining me to discuss the great era of glitter, grunge, thin eyebrows, hammer pants, and total ridiculousness. We're even setting up some interviews with some of the musicians that define the times.
Okay, so if you're older than 30, you might be sitting here going, man, I totally remember that song, but I have no idea who does that. Well, then you better listen and find out.
I'm Naomi Carmack, host of the Ultimate 90s podcast, Dope Nostalgia. You're going to be busting the move again, coming in early 2020. You want to follow us so that you know when we go live? Check out our Twitter at Nostalgia Dope, or you can find us on Instagram at dope_nostalgia. If you've got a question or you just want to be on the show, email us at dopenostalgiapodcast@gmail.com.